The centre of Jewish social life in Melbourne was, for many years, on the cafe strip along Ackland Street. There were cake shops, bookshops and delis, and a cafe called Scheherazade. I used to go to Scheherazade when I lived in Melbourne every once in a while. It wasn't so much for the Wiener Schnitzel, the cabbage soup. You went to Scheherazade for the atmosphere, for the gold wallpaper, the loud political discussions in Polish and Yiddish, and the old men playing chess. If you went to Scheherazade feeling miserable with a cold, they'd be super nice to you and bring you soup. To suburban Gentiles like me, Scheherazade, it just looked like the height of old-world European cosmopolitanism. Some people used to call it the Jewish Parliament. John Zalesnikov grew up behind the counter at Scheherazade, making coffee and observing the theatre of it all because his parents were the owners. They were like a lot of their clientele. They were European Jews who'd somehow survived the Holocaust and escaped to Melbourne, which was about as far away from Europe as they could get. It seemed like everyone that came to Scheherazade had a story, and John's family were no different. Hello, John.
Hi, Richard.
I'm so glad to be talking about Scheherazade. I got so excited when Anne Fitzgerald suggested we talk to you about this. There was always artwork on the wall. Is that artwork that was accepted by your parents in payment for meals sometimes?
Absolutely. There was a very famous Australian artist, John Howley, who used to have breakfast, lunch and dinner there, not only him but his wife and children, and rather than paying cash, he paid in artwork. There was other work, a fairly famous Austrian Jewish sculptor called Kurt Doldig, who used to draw on napkins at Scheherazade to pass away his time, and those napkins and these drawings and etchings, they were framed and they adorned the walls of Scheherazade as well.
There was always this distinctive music playing in the background. What was that music? I was listening. Klezmer music or something like that? Or what was it?
No, I don't really know. I think it was, sometimes we reminisce and we look back at things and we make it feel that it was really much more exciting and better than it used to be. My guess is it was just normal traditional radio.
Maybe. I don't know, but I distinctly remember something happening there. Maybe I'm over-glamorising it.
Because I used to have as a typical child in the 1960s, if you're Australian, you wanted to be accepted Australian, you loved sport. So I can remember on hot summer days listening to cricket behind the bar, or as I was making coffees, and my mother was yelling, "Turn down the radio, nobody wants to hear the cricket scores," and things like that. But my guess, it was just whatever music was available on the radio at the time.
Like I say, I thought it was, like, it had this kind of New York kind of Jewish sophistication to it. It felt slightly melancholic and old world, and it had been there for such a long time. It had this kind of great glamour to it. Is that how it felt to you at the time?
No. I mean, it's fascinating that you say that to things. I lived above the shop. It was 1950s and 60s weren't as moderate and elaborate. We didn't have the same sort of health rules as we do at the moment. I found it a pretty grotty and dungy place, and it wasn't exciting at all, and none of the people who came in there had ever been to New York. They may well have been the same sort of people, although New York Jews went to New York much earlier than Australian Jews came to Australia. We only really came after the Holocaust. So the people may have had something in common, but the place was certainly not trying to emulate anything in New York. If anything, it was trying to emulate the cafes and restaurants that the customers used to go to in Eastern Europe.
If you try to reimagine yourself as that boy or that kid behind the counter working on the coffee or whatever, if you close your eyes and try to remember how it looked in front of you, what do you see as you see the old Scheherazade?
Well, I see noise, I see action, I see things never being quiet, I see excitement, because if people had the opportunity to argue or to disagree, then they would do so. I always remember one of the waitresses who, if she had been a male, would have been in the Polish army. She wouldn't take orders from people. She would tell people what they had to have and what was good for them. Polite, genteel was not part of the atmosphere there.
You know, there's a Monty Python sketch where I think it's John Cleese or someone Michael Palin goes into a room and he pays for an argument. Goes into the argument room and he pays for an argument and lasts for someone. The Scheherazade was like that, wasn't it? It was a place where you actually looked for an argument. You came there to enjoy an argument.
You did. The one difference was you didn't have to pay. You got the argument whether you liked it or not. If you didn't like arguments, you went elsewhere.
Scheherazade is, you know, famously the woman who is the storyteller in the 1001 Arabian Nights. Is that where the name came from?
Yes and no. My parents had been at university in Lodz in Poland after the Second World War. They had suffered the twin evils of communism and fascism. And my father's father had in fact been shot by Stalin. My father's mother and her family were in fact died at the hands of the Nazis. So when it became obvious in 1948 that in fact Poland was going to go communist, my parents decided they were going to flee. Now, my mother was able to leave legally, but my father, because he had been worked in the partisans, was considered part of the Soviet army, and he hence had to leave Poland illegally. And they organised to meet when they were able to get out of Poland and through Czechoslovakia to Paris at a nightclub called Scheherazade, and that is where the name comes from.
And they met there? They did meet it there?
They did meet there. They had very minimal money, but I think there wasn't so much a cover charge, but you had to drink a certain amount of Calvados.
Or a half bottle of champagne or something like that. Yes.
And that's what they did. And they tried to drink it as slowly as possible so they could spend as much time as possible at the Scheherazade nightclub.
It's so romantic. Let's track the story of your amazing mother and father and how they came to be owning and operating this place, the Scheherazade. Whereabouts was your dad born?
My dad was born in a city called Vilna, which was then in Poland. After the Russian Revolution and the First World War, there had been a conflict between Lithuania and Poland won the city that became Vilna. So my father was born in Vilna, and he lived there for some time. In 1939, following the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Poland was divided.
That's right. The Nazi Germany got one half.
That's right.
And the Soviet Union got the other
half. My father lived in the eastern half. Vilna was in the eastern half, and so that became a Soviet fiefdom. The Soviets came in, and his father, who had been a socialist but an anti-Bolshevik, was taken away by the Soviets, never to be seen again.
So he was a socialist, but not quite socialist enough for Stalin.
No, and for Stalin, the worst people were the socialists, because they were the ones who could have... he was a Menshevik, and they were the ones who could really oppose him and things like that. So they were the ones who went first.
Stalin also had an anti-Semitism, which was almost as bad as Hitler's, too, as it turned out. We know this now, but I don't know if it was properly understood at the
time.
My
father would argue that he would argue with you about almost as bad. He would say there was no difference. And he actually used to claim to me that, in fact, Hitler learned a lot of his techniques and a lot of his detention centres and camps and concentration camps actually came from Stalin and what he'd done in the 1930s.
So Stalin took his half of Poland, and then the Nazis invaded and attacked the Soviet Union.
That's correct.
And then they took over that bit of
Poland.
That's
right, in June 1941.
So what happened to the very large Jewish population of Vilna once the Nazis came?
Well, most of them went into a ghetto. So we're talking about June 1941, they went into ghettos, would have been forced labour. Some of them might have been sent to detention camps. But they essentially lived in that ghetto for 2 years. 1943 was a year, with a few exceptions, where the Germans actually evacuated the ghettos and destroyed them, and generally on Jewish holidays. So Passover, which was in April 1943, the Germans destroyed the Warsaw ghetto. The Jewish New Year, which is in fact in September, they destroyed the ghetto of Vilnius, and most of the people were sent to the forests of Panari, and in fact they were executed.
What about your dad and his family, though?
Well, my father's family, meaning his mother, his sister, her husband and two children, they were all liquidated from the ghetto and executed at Panari. My father was a member of the United Partisans organisation, and what they managed to do was they managed to use the cutlery they had in their apartment to cut through the floorboards and escape through the sewers. The leader of the United Partisans organisation was the sanitation engineer in Vilna, and he was able to lead them. He knew the sewers, and he was able to lead them 50 kilometres into the forests of Rudniki, where, in fact, they lived for the next 14 months.
My God! Your father escaped out of the Jewish ghetto of Vilnius by virtue of cutlery, essentially.
Exactly, yes, yes.
There's an omen for restaurants in the future. Yes. That's not being too glib about things, no. I don't know. Nonetheless, that's amazing. So the whole time he was in the ghetto, Vilna, which became Vilnius later on, what was he doing? You said he was a partisan. What did that mean?
Well, he was organising resistance. I mean, there are lots of really interesting ethical questions coming out of resistance, because if the Germans found that people resisting are not following their orders, then what they would do, because the Germans had set up a Jewish police, because it was much easier for to have a Jewish police maintain the ghetto than to have German soldiers doing that. And if anyone didn't comply with the Jewish police, they would have been severely punished. So any resistance was sort of met with, you know, maybe 1,000 people executed or sent to forced labour camps or things like that. So there was a lot of argument within the partisans as to how they should resist and things like that. And at one time, for example, the leader of the resistance for Germans said, "We want him." Okay, and there was a big argument amongst resistance fighters and the community, who felt, well, maybe we won't get exterminated. Maybe if we comply with what the Germans do, we'll be okay. They won't treat us badly. This guy, Isaac Wittenberg, was actually given to the Germans because of that. He'd been in hiding, and there was just too much pressure on the partisans to give him up.
So the decision was, the tension was between partisans like your dad and others who thought, we have to go along to try and keep everyone alive.
Yeah.
But in the long run, your dad and the partisans were right, but I don't suppose that was necessarily completely clear to everyone at the time.
No, it wasn't completely clear, and one can make an argument. I mean, of course, history is hindsight, you know, but in a city called Lodz, because, in fact, the Jewish police cooperated and the Jewish council cooperated with the Germans, and, in fact, they were very important for the war effort, you know, fixing uniforms, making munitions, that ghetto was not destroyed until October 1944, about 15 months after all the others. And people survived a lot longer. There is a much greater percentage of survivors from that city than any other city in Poland, because whereas most people had to survive 2 years in Auschwitz, these people only had to survive 9 months. So you can argue about whether resistance is or is not a good idea.
So your dad escaped with these partisans through the sewer system and came out in a forest, I don't know what, 50 k's away or thereabouts.
Yes.
What did he do then?
Well, he essentially blew up railway station, railway lines, tried to engage in conflict with not so much German soldiers, but Lithuanian collaborators and things like that, and also just survive. So they had no, you know, place to live, no food to have, so we would have to break into homes to get food and things like that. Just survive. I suppose initially it was survival, and then secondly it was to help, because the Soviets were starting to push in. They were moving west, and in fact in October 44 they did come into Vilna, so to help them lead the way to liberate towns in eastern Poland.
It's amazing to think your dad survived the war. I mean, surviving as a kind of saboteur and partisan and being a Jewish man in that part of Europe at that time, it's amazing he survived.
Well, it was You're right. It was incredibly difficult. It was incredibly dangerous. I'm sure a lot of it was luck, and some of it would have been skill. It's very difficult to know what the combination was.
So once the Soviet Union forces, the forces of the Soviet Union, rolled into Vilna and pushed the Nazis out, how did that change life for your father then?
He had to rebuild it. I mean, it was very difficult for him because he had only ever learnt to be a fighter and to resist and to oppose. And somehow he had to come into a situation which was new, and he had no family and he had no support. He had no friends there. His family had been annihilated. He was in a situation where he was a member of the Soviet partisans, but as he kept on being told by lots of people, he had to be very wary there because his family had had a history of conflict with the Soviets.
And that counted too, didn't it?
So, oh, he definitely did, yes.
So he concluded he had no future then in what was going to be then the Soviet Union, I suppose, after the war.
Yeah, he certainly included that. And he went to Poland, and he went to university in Poland, because the one thing he did was his family had been very involved, as well as politically being socialists. They were also involved in a Jewish language called Yiddish, and he wanted to become a Yiddish teacher. So he went to university in Poland with the hope of becoming a Yiddish teacher.
And is that how he met your mum?
Yes, he met my mother at the at university in Poland, where she wanted to be a doctor. So they had both decided, and there was lots of conflict. Even in the ghettos, there were conflicts amongst Jews. Some people felt that we had to have our own national homeland and have a state, which we eventually do have, of Israel. Others thought, well, the only way to improve things was to stay where you were. You might say these internationalists and third world people, my parents were very much... They've changed now, but at that time they were very much internationalists, and they felt, we are Jewish, but we're also Polish, and we're going to stay here and fight the revolution and change things. And it's only, you know, over the when they saw the way things were going over the next 2 years that they concluded they had no hope of doing that in Poland.
What had been your mother's and your mother's family's experience of the Holocaust, John?
They had it a bit easier, although when I say easier, it was still pretty awful. They lived in the western part of Poland. So that part of Poland went Nazi in September 1939. Now, my mother's father, the one thing I would say about him was he could see the way things were going. He was shrewd. Immediately the Germans started coming, he fled eastwards. And in fact, he managed to cross the border into the Soviet part of Poland. And then, as were lots of Austrian Jews and Hungarian Jews in Australia in the Second World War, he was declared an enemy alien, because he was seen as a German citizen, even though he was fleeing the Germans. And so for much of the next 6 years, they were deported around Soviet Central Asia. So they would have been in Uzbekistan and Turkestan and Afghanistan, just living from day to day. But at least they weren't under the daily threat of Nazi annihilation.
So your parents met and fell in love and decided to meet up, escape separately, and meet up at the Café Scheherazade or Café Scheherazade or the Scheherazade in Paris.
Yes. My mother went with her family, my father by himself.
Then Australia. Why Australia? Was it because it was the furthest point on the globe away from the Holocaust?
Okay. I believe initially it was where they got their visas first, but in fact I have heard many people say that they came to Australia because they wanted to get as far away from any conflict as possible, and they had no concept of New Zealand, of course. They felt that Australia was a place that they could get away to, that it would be safe and secure. They were worried that the United States might get into conflict with the Soviet Union and there would be continued war and bloodshed and things like that. Their belief was that Australia was safe and secure.
How did they come to Australia?
in 1951, there were no planes. So Bay lived for 3 years in Paris. And I mean, it was a pretty miserable existence because they weren't allowed to work. There would have been no benefits. They would have relied upon the support of the Jewish community in Paris. Eventually, in March 51, they went to Genoa, and they would have caught a fairly large ship to Australia, which I think took about 3 months.
What did your father do for work when he first got to Australia?
Well, my father was essentially a labourer. He had no skills at all. I mean, the skills he had of were resistance, and that's why he might have been better off going to Israel, where he could have joined the army. In Australia, he had no skills. No engineering skills, no medical skills, no anything like that. He was a Yiddish teacher. There wasn't terribly much of a demand for it there, so he just took whatever job he could get.
Your mum, what did she do? Did she find work?
They had had me towards the end of their stay in Paris. And when they got to Australia, after about a year or two, I became quite ill. This was the last great outbreak in Australia of polio. So I had polio.
And that meant you had to be confined to bed or to hospital?
I had to be confined to hospital, Fairfield Infectious Diseases Hospital, for some time. And after that, I know a lot of people who had polio had Purfey's disease.
Oh, yes.
That time, the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne sent their people with Purfey's disease to a hospital in Mount Eliza, which is about 45 kilometres southeast of the city, and it meant that her coming to visit me would take about 2 hours each way each day. Now, I'm not too sure how many times a week that occurred, but obviously almost all of her life at that stage would have been spent coming to see me. So she really did not work at that stage, didn't in fact work until 1958.
Could you speak any English when you were admitted to hospital?
No, I couldn't speak English at all.
Strange for you. How odd. Did you fully understand what was going on?
Well, it's interesting. I cannot actually remember anything until I was 6 and a half, whether I was psychologically blocking out what was happening. I have sort of images, but I don't remember it, of me being in traction in hospital. But I really can't remember anything until my first year at school. And even then, there was one fascinating incident, because my father, as you could well appreciate, was very angry about what had happened in the Holocaust. And I was going to school on crutches. And apparently, and I do not recall this, I beat a boy with my crutches. And the only reason was he was German. And the teacher called my father in and said, look, we really understand how you feel and how you've been treated, but you're in Australia now, and you know such behaviour is not acceptable, and you can't be encouraging your son or almost pushing him to feel this level of anger. The interesting thing is, I don't remember that. This story has had to be recounted to me, and I would have been 6 at that stage.
How old were you when you could walk without crutches?
Probably about 10. By the age of 10, I didn't need any crutches at all.
And are there still any lingering effects today from polio and Perthes disease that you have?
I've got 1 foot larger than the other, but it's not significant. And I tend to salivate a little more than normal. But the answer is no. Nothing that's really significant, which was really great. Why? People are just lucky sometimes.
Did you stand out at school?
I didn't stand out at school, particularly not in the later years, because I went to a school called Elwood High School, which was not that far from St Kilda. And at that school, at least a third of the other kids were Jewish. In fact, the people who stood out at the school were almost the people who weren't Jewish. I remember there was, you know, maybe it was Australia's first multicultural high school, because I can remember there was a Scottish boy who turned up at our school and abused a Ceylonese, now we call it Sri Lanka, a Ceylonese boy, calling him a nigger. This Scottish boy was taken, and I know because I was was in the group Idor Korda, and had, well, a different form of restorative justice. He had, you know, he was hit by all the other Jewish kids, and he left the school. So Elwood High School was not a, was a school where Jewish kids probably felt fairly safe.
Did you all have a conversation amongst yourselves that this was unacceptable to call a Sri Lankan kid a nigger? Was that...
No, I can't recall ever having a conversation about that. I just feel we all felt that way. I think it was pretty much automatic that we didn't accept what had happened in Europe in the 40s, and we weren't going to accept it in Australia in the 60s.
Conversations with Richard Feidler. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Today you're hearing the story of John Zelestikov. John's family came to Australia in the very early 1950s and set up the legendary Scheherazade Cafe. This is a cafe that's been the subject of books, a stage play, because it formed a kind of, well, Jewish parliament in Ackland Street, St Kilda, where people would come for the Wiener Schnitzel, the cabbage rolls, and for an argument. And it was full of artwork. It was a home for artists, bohemians, creative people. And John used to work there as a kid. I'm figuring after that very exciting life that your father had had during the war, was Australia a bit of an anticlimax for him after all that?
Well, it was an incredible anticlimax. And interesting enough, he came to Australia at the age of 27. He just passed away this year, so he managed to live another 62 years. And he always found it incredibly difficult because he had a wealth of stories and excitement, and people weren't interested in that. I mean, Australia was the end of the world. People wanted to get away, particularly in the 60s and 70s. People didn't want to hear about what had happened in the Holocaust. They didn't want to reflect on bad times. As we're getting further and further away, it's probably easier to deal with the hurt. But he was wanting to talk about it. He was wanting to go to meetings. He was running ceremonies and things like that. Nobody else was interested.
Isn't that strange? Because there was that strange period in the post-war years, yes, where there was this kind of pall of silence. Everyone had known what had happened. So it's not like the information wasn't out there. Right up until the 1970s, I think there was the American TV series on the Holocaust and the Klaus Landsman film and Shoah.
Yes, absolutely.
And suddenly these stories came out. It seemed like it was so awful it needed 30 years of silence.
Well, yeah, you just don't like... People hate feeling a victim. I mean, if you're a victim, you rather than say, well, why the other people do this to me, you think to yourself, why did I allow myself to be a victim? Why did this happen? Why do bad things happen to good people? So they didn't want to go into depth. They didn't want to discuss it. My father, who'd never been in a camp, who in many ways hadn't, well, he'd been a victim in terms of his family and things like that, but he was able to resist, fight back, recreate it. He was different. And even if you look at the mental problems, the psychological problems of people coming through that period, the ones who resisted tended to find it easier and to want to talk about this. And it took him so long until anybody else would listen.
I suppose he hadn't had to go through that daily process of fighting to remain human, which so many people in the camps did.
Indeed. Indeed. And I mean, to them, just the small things, you know, the going to the beach, the going to a restaurant and eating, they were thrilling and exciting because it's something that they hadn't been able to do in their life. My father was always looking for something more.
Did your parents try to assimilate? I know there was assimilationist pressure on migrants at the time. Did they try to assimilate insofar as become less Jewish, to blend in more to the background?
That's an interesting question. It's not one I've ever even thought about. I think the real answer is no. First of all, the background has changed. I mean, Australia is a very different country now in the second decade of the 21st century than it was 60 years ago. So my parents don't have to assimilate because Australia's become more like them. rather than they becoming... So, no, they haven't had to eat white bread and, you know, wear hats and things like that. Because and Australia has actually wanted them. I think the things that they're stunned at is they have so many people, and it's not only people in the Jewish community, marvelling at what they've been doing and wanting to be like them, rather than wanting them to change to be like Australia was in the 1960s.
And was it ever really an either-or proposition anyway? I mean, you can be very Jewish and very Australian at the same
absolutely.
Time, can't you? In the way you can be very Chinese and very Australian too.
I mean, Australia, look, you do hear, you know, occasionally people being intolerant in Australia. And one of the instances that came to me was last year when Ed Husic, who was a Labor minister, people criticised him for being sworn in on the Quran. Now, obviously, I'm not Muslim, so I wouldn't have done that, but I thought that was marvellous. And he pointed out very clearly he wasn't being un-Australian, because Australian is not a religion. It's a country, it's a system of government, it's a value system. And yeah, Judaism's exactly the same. The beauty of Australia is that some of the most significant Australians have been Jewish. People like Isaac Isaacs, John Monash, Zelman Cowan, they didn't hide it.
John Safran says that Australia has provided the proof that God is in fact irrefutably Jewish, because on Grand Final Day in 1966, St Kilda was playing, and the day fell on Yom Kippur,
right,
when every Jewish person in St Kilda was praying for a St Kilda victory. St Kilda won, which he says provides irrefutable proof that God is Jewish.
Indeed. I still remember, although I was not at that time a St Kilda fan, but I still remember the day very well.
So they set up Scheherazade. They call it Scheherazade because that's the cafe that they met in Paris. And, of course, it's a place of storytelling, which is entirely appropriate. But why a restaurant? Why did they choose a restaurant?
My father led the exciting, tumultuous life. But in many ways, because of that, he wasn't well prepared to make, you know, business decisions. My mother had received this my uncle owned a property in Acton Street, St Kilda, and my mother thought of buying it, and she thought, what could she do? She had a few criteria. First of all, she had myself and by then my sister had been born, so we needed to be nearby. She needed to work because it wouldn't be enough just my father working. And also, she needed to keep him in the restaurant, because my father was, if you had to define his profession, you would say he was a politician. Okay, he was never a member of parliament. He was never paid for doing it, but he viewed himself in his life, as had his father been, as a professional politician. So my mother thought, what is one way that we can hone his skills and that we can actually keep him there? And he could do all his politicising. He could speak to people. He could use his skills in a restaurant. And that's what he did.
Maitre d'. Like, the skills of being a maitre d' are really very similar to a politician in a lot of ways, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Now in those days, one never thought of Scheherazade as having a maitre d', because you think of maitre d' as very established French restaurants. But yes, he was doing that. He didn't do the cooking. He didn't do much of the actual physical work at Scheherazade, but he was the host, and he was a pretty good host.
Who were the original clientele of Scheherazade?
A lot of the original clientele were Holocaust survivors. It seems to me, and I've never done a demographic study, but the most of the Holocaust survivors who were certainly coming to the Scheherazade were single men. Okay, they would have been single men because maybe they survived the most. Maybe they came to Australia. There weren't that many other women to get into relationships. They would have been getting older. A lot of them didn't look after themselves terribly well, certainly didn't cook and know how to cook. So coming to a place like Scheherazade was an ideal place to go. It was a myriad. It was the Holocaust survivors, but it was also, in the 1960s and 70s, St Kilda was the cultural mecca of Melbourne, because there was no South Bank. There weren't the Arts Centre. The major theatre was the Palais Theatre.
The National Theatre down the road.
And the National Theatre down the road. So a lot of people were coming to St Kilda. And also, people just in summer coming to St Kilda Beach. Particularly the newer migrants love going to St Kilda Beach. My daughter, who's actually a lifesaver at Elwood, tells me that they have far more drownings than the surfside places like Torquay. And I said to her, why? And she says, because the people who come to Elwood Beach can't swim. You know, she says they're all migrants who have no idea of how to cope with the water. And that's what St Kilda Beach was like. The sort of people who didn't know it really to go to the beach, but wanted to go out, and going to a cafe was part of the beach experience.
Now, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong in this, John, that Melbourne in the post-war years had more Holocaust survivors than any city in the world outside of Israel.
That's correct, yes.
It is true.
It is because, and it was out of design, Arthur Calwell, the immigration minister and the chiefly ministry, was very generous. And I mean, it was political ties he had to people in the Jewish community, like Leo Fink and others. But also, so Australia took in a very large number of Holocaust survivors, which the Menzies government continued doing. So we finished in Melbourne with a very large Holocaust survivor community. And also the Jewish community of Melbourne prior to the Second World War had been very small. So the survivor community was almost the whole of that community.
So your cafe is made up of broken people.
Yeah, exactly. And I like to say it was essentially their home. They might have slept in boarding houses, and there were lots of boarding houses and other places in St Kilda, but they actually lived at Sherazad.
How is Melbourne's Jewish life different from Sydney's in terms of cultural background of the European Jewish migrants that came to both cities?
Well, the Sydney Jewish community has generally been Central European. So
Hungarian,
yeah, German, Austrian and things like that. They tend to want to integrate much more. It tends to be less likely to speak Yiddish. So it tends to be a very different wanting to, you know, less involved in Zionism and things like that, because wanting to integrate to a community. So you see different, very different value systems. I mean, one could argue some of the value systems in Sydney are really much better, because in Sydney there's a unified Jewish appeal, whereas in Melbourne every Jewish organisation, whether it be schools or whether it be synagogues or whether it be welfare societies, they compete for each other for funds. I mean, the thing that often stuns me about Judaism is the internal fights. And even in the ghettos, I mean, it might, you know, yes, it can be funny in Melbourne when you've got one school fighting another for finance. But even in the ghettos, there were tremendous conflict between the various organisations as to, you know, how much we should work along with each other, how much we should work with the Nazis, things like that. I don't know why, but it is just very difficult to get a cooperation from Eastern European Jews.
There was always plenty of argument in Scheherazade. Did it ever come to fist fights?
It never really got to fist fights, no, but it got to a very vigorous verbal sort of arguments. I can't ever recall any fist fights or my father being forced to throw people out or even worse.
Is that because people were enjoying themselves too much? Like was there an absence of real rancor, real malice and hatred, or was it that there nonetheless?
There was an absence of real rancor and hatred, and they realised that they had to agree with each other. I mean, where it actually gets worse is in a country like Israel, where they do shoot their politicians, and it's not only Yitzhak Rabin who was assassinated, but I remember politicians, I think, are Lazarov and Dizengoff in Israel were assassinated because people disagreed with their viewpoints. I think in Australia, because of our actual Australian tradition of tolerance, and also realising that if Jewish people didn't work together, there could be severe repercussions. You didn't have the sort of antagonism that you might have in other places.
I noticed there were some seriously brilliant people that came out as Holocaust survivors. Did you hear some amazing people say, were there some really clearly outstanding overachievers who'd escaped out of Europe who washed up in Scheherazade?
Probably the sort of people who were there regularly are the ones who weren't achieving. Okay, I mean, I can think of probably the most significant Holocaust survivor I can think of in Australia is actually Sydney, not Melbourne, someone like Frank Lowy. Lots of other people, the people who did succeed generally had their own infrastructure and had their own families and things like that. So, yeah, there are plenty of great people who were successes in the Melbourne Jewish community. They would have occasionally come to Scheherazade, but they weren't in there every day. The sort of people who were in there every day, and I really got to know, were the ones who in many ways were the ones whose lives had been severely broken and they couldn't recreate it. And so what Scheherazade was doing was helping them recreate it, you know, providing them with food for the body, providing with them food for the soul in terms of having someone to talk to, someone who could give them a sort of lifestyle they'd had at the back. The more significant people in the Jewish community who were doing well might come in once every week or once every month.
I've known quite a few children of that community. That's more my generation,
right,
John. And they've often got stories about their traumatised parents. I think some of that trauma definitely cascaded down into their lives and they felt it. Have you noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. Probably the best known Australian, because she's a writer, is someone like Lily Brett. And you just, you know, and you're mentioning Rachel Berger.
Rachel Berger's the comedian. Mine, yeah.
Yeah, they, you know, that's their lifestyle. Just the same as country and western singers, if they hadn't had a traumatic life, have got nothing to sing about. These writers and these comedians, because of their experience of going through the Holocaust, have something really deep to say. I mean, these sort of people who've had rather comfortable, bland existence often don't really have much different to say.
You know, the thing that both Rachel Berger and Lily Brett have in common is they're both hysterically funny. Lily Brett was on the program. She said she hates it when people ask, you know, how are you? When people say, great, fantastic. She says, I hate that. She hates it when her husband does. I said, why? She says, because the body's so intricate, so many things could go wrong. You're almost certainly lying when you're saying fantastic, because it could all go horribly wrong. Don't you understand that? And when my husband says he's fantastic, I say, don't say that. Don't speak like that. That's how that is. That kind of spinning all that kind of misery into comedy gold seems to be
sure,
part of the way of dealing with it.
Particularly when you're used to it, and, you know, when your life, and this is often a way, and one of the things that I think you'll find stunning about the Melbourne Jewish community is the way they've been able to recreate life, and the way that they can, you know, be optimistic and get things moving. And I think to a very large extent, the Café Scheherazade helped them do it.
You had two sisters as well, John.
That's correct, yes.
Was there a difference in the way that you absorbed your parents' history to the way that they absorbed?
There was an incredible difference, and it's got to do with age. So whereas I was 6.5 years older than the older of my two sisters and 9.5 years older than the younger, and they didn't live above the restaurant. They didn't work in the restaurant. And they actually went to different schools. I went to Elwood High School. They went to Jewish day schools. So it was a totally different, you might almost say that they were a different generation, because they were brought up very differently, treated differently, and, yeah, came up with different value systems too.
What's so awful is that, sadly, both your parents lived to see both your sisters pass away.
Yeah, that is.
A car accident, the other one to cancer.
Yes.
That's awful for you. And I mean, of course, that was maybe the major trauma of their lives in the end, I suppose.
I would imagine neither of my parents are the sort of people who, you know, speak openly about how they feel or things like that. So if you do ever ask them how they feel, they would say, okay. But there is no doubt that personal tragedies are much more difficult to deal with than public tragedies, because public tragedies, everybody suffers, everybody's aware of it. So if you're in New York on 9/11 and someone died, everyone understands it, everyone knows about it, they feel your grief. But if you have a child killed in a car accident at the age of 17, or one died of breast cancer at the age of 50, it is just so much more difficult. Other people are happy and you're not. And when people come and commiserate with you, I know my parents found it very, very difficult to cope with that.
John, I'm looking at your title at the moment. So, I mean, you obviously didn't keep working at Scheherazade for the rest of your life. You are the Professor of Information Systems, Laboratory of Decision Support and Dispute Management, the College of Business at Victoria University, and you've also run in your life how many marathons?
180.
That's just bad. Clearly you're a very driven man. You must be to go that far academically and to run that many marathons. Where's the engine of that come from, do you think?
Again, I don't think I've ever thought about that, and I don't think of myself as driven. And I think when when you're in a university atmosphere, everybody is driven, okay? So you're maybe not that different than in everybody else. I just absolutely enjoy it.
I'm looking at your wife who's laughing at the moment. Yeah, you know what? When I run up and down two flights of stairs, I think I deserve a medal for that. You run 180 marathons. You don't really see that as a sign that you're a driven human being?
I absolutely love it. I mean, I like getting out there and running and relaxing and enjoying it. I like the idea, probably where I am a bit anal, is I like being in control, okay? And I think to myself, going out and running is good for you and, you know, it improves the quality of my life. But I'm not driven, and I think running is one of these beautiful sports where you don't have to compete against anyone else. You don't have to beat someone. When I was a 25-year-old, I was a reasonable runner. I was never a great runner. Now I come last in almost every marathon, and I don't care less. Just finishing is great, and I achieve it, and that's one of the beauties of running. You can come last and feel very satisfied. Most other events in your life, if you are not up there, whether it's a tennis match or a football match, you become devastated.
I went back to Melbourne not so long ago looking for Scheherazade, and it wasn't there. What happened to Scheherazade?
My parents sold the restaurant to somebody else. They still own the premises. They do even now in 1996, because my father was 72 and he couldn't continue running it. My parents had some partners in the late 1960s, and their son wanted to buy the restaurant. So my parents sold it to him, but my parents wished to be involved. Unfortunately, after the first 3 years of the lease, he said, no, you can't be involved, and if you want to eat at the restaurant, you're going to have to pay. And to say to my parents, after having run the restaurant for 38 years, look, it wasn't that they actually had a contract where they owned a piece of property. To them, Scheherazade is them. It is their life. And they became so furious and so angry, I suppose, that they weren't being respected, that when it came up for a lease after the 12 years, they said, well, if you're not going to be generous to us and if you're not going to realise our contribution, we'll charge you a commercial lease for that property, which is what they did. And he wasn't able to afford the commercial lease. Unfortunately, Atkins Street has become very expensive in restaurants. In fact, there are far fewer restaurants there now than there used to be. So he moved the restaurant to Caulfield. Apparently, it didn't go that well, and he sold it after 2 years.
So it's gone.
It's gone.
But then Ackland Street, as it was, is gone too, more or less.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah. That's the beauty of Arnold Zabel's book on the play, because everything changes. Melbourne of the 1960s doesn't exist. Scheherazade doesn't exist, but we do have our memories.
How important was Scheherazade in reconnecting all those broken young men who'd gotten out of Europe into life, away from horror and what might have understandably have been quite a cynical view on life and human beings after having escaped the Holocaust?
Look, I think it was vital. I remember there's one gentleman, I don't know his proper name, but we used to call him Kivala, and he would catch the tram from St Kilda Junction. He lived a Jewish old age home, and he would spend every day there. And he'd almost be my father's protector. because for him, he had nothing else to do. He had Parkinson's, and it gave him a life. There were lots of other people coming, as I said, from the boarding houses around there who that was somewhere they where they could talk. I don't even think, here I'm going to maybe say something that seems strange, to these sort of people, I don't even think it was the food that was important. I think it was the comradeship, the opportunity to speak to people. I didn't even love the food that much, I must say. I know I'm a heretic, but it was the companionship, the feeling valued, feeling warm that was really important.
Where am I going for matzo ball soup in Melbourne from now on? Where do I go?
Well, the interesting thing is there are so many shops. I mean, it has really changed. I live in South Caulfield. When I shifted out there in the 60s, I lived fairly close to my parents. That used to be suburbia, the end of the tram line. We have three Jewish restaurants across the road from us. There's just so much competition now because people want it.
All I know is when I'm feeling sorry for myself, John, I want to be served matzo ball soup by a waitress in her 60s who calls me darling.
Right.
That's what I want in life.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's lovely hearing this story. I'm so glad you came in to tell it, John. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
And I spoke to John in 2013. He's still enjoying his running. And last year, John represented Australia in the World Masters Athletics in Lyon, in France. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.